Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. November is Native American Heritage Month. In honor of the occasion, today we'll be airing part one of an interview series with Kumeyaay Elder Charlie Brown in our Tribal Beats segment. In part one, he'll be telling us his own story, which includes jumping out of airplanes with the U.S. Forest Hotshot team. And then next week, he'll talk about the rich cultural history of the Kumeyaay people in our region. Then in our bookshelf segment on today's show, you'll hear our interview with Paula Margulis, local author of the novel Coyote Moon and Favorite Daughter, the true story of Pocahontas told from a Native American perspective. We'll also tell you about two local Native Americans who are being honored this month as local heroes by KPBS and Union Bank. Also today, we thought it would be a good time to replay our interview with Sequan Chairman Daniel Tucker, taped originally at the debut of their Emmy Award-winning film, about the history of the Sequan people and the Kumeyaay Nation. November is also the time when the holiday season kicks off across East County. On Destination East County, we'll tell you about some exciting events coming up, from a holiday open house to the Mother Goose Parade and much, much more. But first, we have some updates on several close races in Tuesday's election. Now, if you think your vote doesn't count, folks, listen up. Several races in San Diego and East County are coming down to a count of the final remaining provisional ballots and absentee ballots dropped at the polls on Election Day, and the ones we're about to tell you about all have less than a 1% margin separating the winners and the losers. The most high-profile of these close races is in the 52nd Congressional District, where Democratic Congressman Scott Peters has taken a narrow lead over Carl DeMaio, the Republican, by just 861 votes. Now, the late votes are expected to favor Peters because of the allegations of a second sexual harassment claim brought by a former staffer of DeMaio 2 days before the election. DeMaio denies the allegations. In the hotly contested San Miguel Fire District, 2 of 3 candidates backed by the Firefighters Union have sufficient votes to oust the incumbents. But the third, Teresa McKenna, is not yet secure in her win, up by just 30 votes over incumbent Richard Augustine. In the Ramona Unified School District, Bob Stooley and Kim Lassley appear to have won, but vying for the third seat, Dick Lemire leads Joyce Dauber by just 15 votes currently. And in Warner Springs, the Warner Unified School Board race is even closer. The top 3 vote-getters vying for 3 seats are separated by just 8 votes, with Daryl McManima on top with 177 votes, while Maria Esther Hill and Michael Estes are tied with 169 votes each. In the Alpine Union School District, Al Guerra leads with 1,754 votes, followed by Eric Ray with 1,619. Close behind is Glenn Dickey with 1,615, but in this 3-seat race, Lou Russo trails Dickey by a mere 35 votes. Russo is also running for re-election on the Alpine Community Planning Group, but he currently trails James Rowe by a mere 20 votes for the 7th-place spot. There are 7 seats in the 9-person race. Similarly, on the Hamul Dilzura Community Planning Group, 1 seat has come down to just a 49-vote difference, with William Hurd currently ahead of Richard Marzek. And in Ramona, Elio Noyes has nosed ahead of Robin Joy Maxson for the 7th available seat by a mere 55 votes. In the Cajon Valley School Board race, Gilberto and Tammy Ortera appear to have won, but Joe Alegria and Deanne Markle are still battling it out for the 3rd seat, separated by less than a 1% margin. Now, it's not just local races where every vote counts. In the 1960 presidential election, a lot of people don't know that John F. Kennedy defeated Richard Nixon for the presidency by an average of just 1 vote per precinct on average across the nation. Now, we have one more piece of important news before we move on to our celebration of Native American Heritage Month. The county is reporting a second death from West Nile virus. The victims lived in San Carlos and on Mount Helix, and both were bitten by mosquitoes close to home. And if that's not enough to convince you to clean up any standing water around your residence where mosquitoes breed, be aware that the first ever yellow fever mosquitoes were found in San Diego County last week at a naval base, and now more of them have turned up in Chula Vista. So the county is asking everyone's help to fight the bite. Next up, we'll bring you our special interviews for Native American Heritage Month, followed by Destination East County and all the fun things to do across East County. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is East County Magazine's radio show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM from beautiful Descanso, high in the Laguna Mountains. And I'm Leon Thompson. I'm here with the Tribal Beat. And today's honored guest is Charlie Brown, who is a longtime ambassador at large for the Kumeyaay Nation. Next to Geronimo, he's my favorite Indian. And we have him here in the studio today. Charlie is witness to many of the changes that have come about in the 19 Indian tribes in our East County area, and we're really privileged to have him here today. Charlie's devoted his life to philanthropic work on behalf of himself and the Indian tribes in East County, San Diego. Welcome to East County Magazine, Charlie.
It's a pleasure to be here and to speak of our nations, our Kumeyaay Nation.
Charlie, before we start talking about your experiences in firefighting as a hotshot and a smoke jumper, recently you were honored by the Byrne Institute.
Yeah, well, I was honored for the Byrne Institute gave me an award. I've been involved with the Byrne Institute for many years and actually spoke at the Byrne Institute camp for the Byrne kids. And it's an amazing place. It's an amazing place to donate money. To see the kids have a wonderful time and not be shamed because all the kids are there for one reason, because they're all been burned. There's nobody to tease them. I was even involved with the one down in Imperial Valley. Don't realize how many people, how many kids come out of Imperial Valley, too, that are burnt. If you've ever been burnt severely, it really hurts. And what they go through, and you have to scrub that, and the skin grafts, and all of that other stuff that those little kids and some of those older kids to go through. And then you have to go to school and have those kids tease you because you're sometimes a little deformed after some of the surgeries and surgeries you go through. And the spirit that they have and the strength that they have to deal with that. And the Byrne Institute gives them one chance a week in a camp where they're all the same, different people getting together and having one of the most wonderful times that they ever have. And making new friends. So if you ever get a chance, any chance to donate to the Byrne Institute, do it if you can. I've been involved with them a lot. Kiwanis, Alpine, they do a wonderful job. One of the largest organizations. Alpine, if you ever ask for help, they're there for you. It's kind of somebody that, like me, can never say no.
Well, we're thankful that you're that way. And you've been giving back to the community for a long time.
Yes, and 24/7. That's the problem. One of the greatest things I was involved with, there was about five or six of us that sat down and talked about a wall of honor in Alpine. We kicked it around, and a lot of people thought, where are we going to get the money? We started out thinking where we can get the money. And at the time, I was working at Viejas at that time, and we stepped up to the plate and gave them some money. We held some fundraisers there at Viejas Forum, and we started building the money. Still, people were doubting that we'd ever build something like that because there's a lot of organizations out there that start something and never finish them. But we were determined to get it done. We worked hard, a lot of meetings, a lot of planning. It was tough, but we were very determined, so we got the wall done. I think there's 38 Kumeyaay veterans on the wall. And let me tell you, in the early age, a long time ago, there was a law written in the United States that said Indians could not go to war. They were supposed to stay here and defend the United States. The Indians said, that's not right. We want to go to war and fight for the United States. This is our country. We were here first. And we will go to war, no matter what the United States says. And they were the largest ones to step up and go to war. Last count was over 200,000 that I know of that went to war. I have many uncles that went to war, many cousins who went to war.
Yeah, it was tradition in our family to do that.
Yes, it was. It was tradition for our people to do that. Tradition for all nations to do that.
Now, before that, or around that time, Charlie, when you were a young man, you were jumping out of perfectly good airplanes. Can you?
Yeah,
I was. Can you tell us a little bit about your hotshot history?
Yeah, I was a fireman. I worked for the Forest Service for many years, but so did my uncles and my dad. It was kind of into our blood, our Indian blood, because a lot of nations have firefighters that do the same thing. And I followed my father's and my uncle's background, and I joined when I was 18. I worked my way up through the ranks and became my superintendent of the hotshots. Ran a crew of about 21 and been a lot of places. But before I got there one time, I asked me if I wanted to go to smoke jumping school. And I said, yeah, I'll try it. Did about everything else I could do. So I went to the smoke jumping school and I learned how to jump out of a perfect airplane. And I thought that was the craziest thing in the world. My first jump landed in a tree, but the top of the tree was dead and went flying through the tree like I was Superman and went crashing through that like it was nothing. Then I got stuck in it. I had to pull all my parachute down and all that other stuff and pack up and walk out. You know, 110 pounds of weight on your back, it wasn't very fun. It was only about a half mile walk, but it was heavy.
Well, for the people who don't know, they would drop you at the head of the fire. That fire is coming right at you, and it's like the last resort to bring in the hot shots and dump them out of an airplane in the front of the path of the fire to cut a fire break.
So. Yeah, so it was fun.
Yes,
it was interesting because when they dropped you in, you were the last resort because there was no roads, there was no way of getting there,
right.
And so they dropped you in and dropped everything to you. You were the last resort until help got there. Sometimes help didn't get there.
Get there in time.
Yeah. So you were there for maybe several days, like maybe several weeks. So it was.
Tinfoil sleeping bag, right?
Yeah, you know, whatever you could find to keep warm, you kept warm. If it was a big hole in the dirt, that's where it was. It wasn't the most peaceful place, but fire changes so quickly, you know. And I've been in situations where fires changed quickly and survived, but I've had several close calls in fire. But you learn from it. We have what they call firefighter standard rules that you're supposed to follow. And that was all brought because of fire situations where people lost their lives and we're supposed to follow them. But sometimes we stretch them, you know, we just stretch them just on the borderline. And we're getting a lot of new people in. It's easy to learn out of a book, but sometimes common sense is what you need.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, and we don't have that sometimes, and it's important that we do, real important, because we still could, you know, we got rain just the other day. East winds are coming. The brush is still dry. You walk in it today, you can hear it crack. It's not over with. We've got a long ways to go. We still got November.
Yes.
And even December,
mm-hmm.
You know, so they're talking maybe some thunderstorms again. So it's not done. All you guys out there, beware of where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Be safe,
because
we don't need anybody else. I've heard deployments. I've heard burnovers already. We're sticking our neck out there we don't need to do. We can replace material things.
Mm-hmm.
We can replace those things that people lose. How do we value life?
Right.
You know, it's important, especially if you have family. How do you do that? You know, it's sad to see. Creator put us here on earth for a reason. Please, you guys out there that's doing all this, don't stick your neck out there. You're not asbestos. Just remember, fight the battles you can win and step back from the ones you're going to lose.
Speaking of fires, the Viejas Fire Department, John Butts, chief out there, and Viejas and the Barona tribes are really often the first line of defense in a brush fire. They're the first ones out there, not only to protect the tribes and the reservations, but really protect us in the cities. As we saw in the Cedar Fire, the Harris Fire, they burn right down into the, practically to the sea. They started out here in East County, where we live. So we're aware of this all the time.
Yeah, that's true. And you even got to look at Saquon. Saquon's there too, you know, and all these backcountry firefighters that are out there, like Saquon, Barona, Viejas, Campo, all these Rincon, Paula, all these reservation tribes are wonderfully trained. They're A1 trained. They're out there fighting these fires. I see them every day. I watch them every day. I worked around them every day. These guys are one of the highest trained people that you could deal with. And if you get a chance, give some money to Make-A-Wish, because some of those kids may not be there. And one other thing we're involved with is called Prom Night. And it's for kids that maybe never get to see their prom because they have cancer. And it's held down at Hall of Champions. And Drew Brees has something to do with this one. He rents all the limos. And he comes down, and all the limos come down. They have a red carpet to come in. Everything's donated. A big party. They dance and this and that. We've been involved with them for about 10 years. And what was really cool about it is sometimes you've been there 10 years, and you know some of the kids, and you miss them because they're not there when you come back the next year.
So tell me about your experience in Valencia.
Okay, well, I was we're on a fire called the Pacoima Fire, and we're working down canyon, and we kept coming out about 6 times, and the 7th time we told them we weren't coming out, and fire was coming. It was about 2:30 in the morning, and it blew over us, and when we got down to the bottom of the canyon, there was a bunch of ladybugs, and I had a yellow shirt on. And it turned out to be all red because the ladybugs covered us completely with be millions of ladybugs down in that canyon bottom. And a fire blew over us, and we walked out the other side where the other crew was coming down towards us. And you could see where they dropped all their tools and everything, and they were burnt all up. You can see their chainsaws melted all on the ground, and their nozzles and their hose and all the stuff that they left behind, their tools and everything were melted. We walked out the other side. Everybody thought we burned up in the bottom of the canyon, but no, we made it out. Okay, but
you and the ladybugs survived.
Yeah, me and the ladybugs survived, and 5 other guys survived. So it was kind of interesting to watch the fire go over you.
Yes, I can imagine. Have you ever had the experience of seeing a tree get so hot that it explodes?
Yes, I've had. I've actually seen trees explode, and I've actually seen brush pulled out of the ground. I've seen rocks fly at you. I've seen. Street, those little white things alongside the road you see to keep so at night so it'll keep you see. I've seen a melt that, and I've seen asphalt bubble that has been so hot. So as you drive along, I've seen those little white things as you're driving along in a truck just melt alongside the road as you're driving.
Oh my.
So yeah, it does get a little warm.
Our special guest has been Charlie Brown, Kumeyaay elder and ambassador from the Kumeyaay Nation. Thank you so much for being with us, Charlie.
It's a real honor to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
This has been the first of a 2-part interview with Charlie Brown. The next time Charlie and I get together, I'm going to ask him about the water situation in East County. Why are the lakes going dry? Charlie knows the answer. I'm going to ask about gaming in San Diego County. How did it get started? I'm going to ask about the Los Coyotes Indian Reservation and the changes in the desert in Ocotillo. All those things and more the next time we get together on East County Magazine's Tribal Beat.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Paula Margulies, award-winning author of the historical novel Favorite Daughter, Part 1. She's also written the novel Coyote Heart and a short story collection called Face Value, Collected Stories. My guest is also a contributor to Author Magazine, the San Diego Examiner, and the Writer's Edge. She owns and runs Paula Margulies Communications, a public relations firm for authors and artists. Welcome, Paula. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's begin with your new novel, Favorite Daughter, Part 1. This is the Pocahontas story, but it's told from her perspective. What prompted you to tell such a well-known and iconic story from the Native American point of view, instead of from John Smith's?
Well, you know, I wrote my first novel, which was set here in San Diego, a contemporary novel,
and it was called Coyote Heart, and it was set on the Pala Indian Reservation. So it had a Native American story to it, a theme to it. Mm-hmm. And finished that novel and decided, you know, I was going to write a sequel to it or something similar. And at that time, I happened to read a book by Sina Jeter Naslin, a historical novel called Abundance, which was about Marie Antoinette, the life of Marie Antoinette. And she told the story from her point of view rather than the traditional history right. we've heard about the French Revolution and let them eat cake and all of that.
Right.
She let Marie Antoinette tell her version of what happened. And she was 14 years old when she was first brought to France to marry this king. And it was fascinating. And just to hear that first person voice and get that sure. female perspective on history, I thought, oh, I want to do that. Uh-huh. So I thought, okay, who would I write about? And I've always been interested in Pocahontas. I grew up here in California where we learned, California history in fourth grade when we visited the missions and all of that. So I didn't really know the Pocahontas story. And when I started to read her story, I read both the John Smith version of history, some of his writing, some of the historians that were out there, Massacre and Helen Roundtree. And then I came across some Native American tellings of her story. And the one that was most interesting to me was written by Dr. Linwood Costello, who's a Mattaponi Indian, and with the help of Angela Daniel, who is also Mattaponi. And their version of her story was, he claimed, handed down through oral tradition, 400 years of oral tradition. And his version was very different than the John Smith version. And I thought, oh, here's the story I'd like to tell. And I'd like to let her tell it just
right.
the way Naslin did in her book. So that's how the whole thing came about.
So it's really like uncovering the real story.
Yeah.
And I know that it's this one, the story of Pocahontas, from her point of view, that it's darker than the version that we're familiar with. Tell us about that. How did your research lead you to this darker version? And why do you think it hasn't made its way into popular storytelling until now?
That's a great question. You know, I think so much of history has a male perspective. I think in this case, John Smith wrote quite a bit about his time in the colonies. And that's because the Virginia Company of London had hired him to come to the new land and find, you know, this, you know, gold and whatever other natural resources they were looking for. And so a lot of his writing was, I think his purpose was to make himself look good and to make the colonists right. look good and to make the venture look successful. So the focus was more, I think, on that perspective. And I think the natives that they met along the way were incorporated into his version of the story in order to show him in a good light. Well, when you read the native version of the story, according to Dr. Costello, it's much darker. Gosh, when she first met John Smith, she was 11 years old. She was a young girl. So the romanticized version of the relationship between her and Smith, he was 27 when he came in 1607 to the colony. Yeah, so there's a huge age gap there. I, in my imagination and from what I've read in history, I think they were very good friends. I think they were fascinated with each other, mm-hmm. but she was a very young girl. And so, according to Costello, there never was that romantic relationship. But there was a political reason for her to be involved in that her father saw that she had this, you know, kind of friendship with Smith, and he kind of used that. In fact, she was kind of used by all the men in her life, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of the story
yeah.
is kind of the betrayal and just the way she figured in the history. But according to Costello, it was very dark. She was abducted, which is a known fact in history, after she married Cocoam, and there is dispute over whether he even existed. But for those historians who say she was married to this native, Cocoam, she lived in his village, and his uncle was the chief of the tribe, and the uncle conspired with the colonists for the abduction. They were the ones who actually lured her onboard ship, and her father did not rescue her. I mean, they kind of held her for ransom, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And I think that broke her heart in a lot of ways. And so according to Dr. Costello, when she converted to Christianity, this was coerced. She was held there against her will. According to him, she was raped by the governor of the colony at the time, Thomas Gates. And in fact, he claims that the marriage to John Rolfe, she later married a colonist, that marriage was coerced and that the child that she had with Rolfe was actually from the rape. And that's what the child's name is, Thomas. So according to the oral wow. tradition,
yeah.
this all happened. And at the end of her story, she eventually, you know, married John Rolfe and became kind of a figurehead in England, very well known as kind of a celebrity, and they mm-hmm. brought her over later to England. She met the king and queen, and she later connected with John Smith, who had left in 1609. He burned his thigh in a gunshot incident. I don't know if gunpowder went off in a boat or something. Mm-hmm. He burned himself. He decided he had to go back to England to take care of that, and he never came back. And she was devastated by that. In fact, when she went to Jamestown right after he left and said, "Where is he?" they told her that he had died. So when she eventually was brought to England, she ran into him, and a lot of historians have documented this. So they did meet, and she was very angry with him when she met him. But on the way home from that voyage, the traditional history is that she developed a case of pneumonia and she died. She's 21 years old. She only lived for 10 years. But the Mattaponi Indians, Dr. Costello, in his version, he claims that she was murdered, that she was poisoned. And so it's just a different kind of perspective on the whole thing and how, you know, what her life was really like.
And it really makes us look at, you know, when we judge history by the story that we're handed, we don't always see it from the perspective of the details of the person involved. If she was 11 years old and she was exploited, it puts a whole different light on everything.
It does. It does. And she was an amazing person. I mean, I imagine her as someone who was fascinated with these foreigners, who was fascinated with the idea of another world, who wanted to see that world. Also, she's very astute. She was good at the language, at learning the English language. And, I think her father saw that in her. And that's mm-hmm. why she kind of became a conduit between the colonists and the tribes. Sure. And, so she played an amazing role in history. At the same time, she was kind of used.
Right.
and so it's kind of interesting just to see that native perspective.
Yeah. A gifted, curious young woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or a young girl, I should say, in the beginning. How about you? Are you Native American heritage?
I am not. I'm full-blooded Italian, both sides. Although my father was always interested in Native history and Native artifacts, so I kind of grew up mm-hmm. with, you know, a respect for Native culture and traditions mm-hmm. and music and art. And he was very much into that. He passed away a year ago, and so that was something I grew up with that. So I've always had that interest.
So you've crossed cultures as well.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit.
Now, let's go back to Pocahontas. She's from this native world where strangers appear in the shore of her village. When you were doing your research and you were learning about that lost world, can you share with us any details that really struck with you that you hadn't heard about previously that you think are the most telling of what life was like back then?
That's a good question. You know, as I imagine it, at the time when John Smith and the colonists first appeared in the New World, the Native American tribes there had encountered the Spaniards. They've already been visited by other European cultures, mm-hmm. and those were not good encounters. And I think my sense from the history and what I've read is that they could tell that they were facing change, that these people that were coming now more often and more, that was one of their concerns when John Smith landed. Are there more? Are you going to live here? Are you, you know, what are you doing here? And as the supply vessels kept coming, they realized that these people are not going to go away. And there was some mm-hmm. dispute among the tribe as to what to do. Chief Powhatan was friendly. He was curious about them, willing to trust them, but his interest was to have them help him fight the Spaniards if they ever return. His brother, Opechancanough, also a chief, was not open to having them there and didn't want any kind of relationship with them. So there was a lot of, I think within the tribe, a lot of division and kind of disagreement over what to do. So I think it brought in a time of it was tumultuous and mm-hmm. kind of frightening and kind of sad, because I think some of the natives there realized as more and more of the colonists arrived that their culture was going to change. And so it was a time of big change.
They saw the end coming, really.
They started to. Yeah, they started to. It was hard to accept, you know, and I think that led to a lot of mistakes in terms of the relationship and how they negotiated for themselves. And,
right.
Yeah, so it was interesting. And the world itself it was interesting writing this book, because when I wrote my first book, that was a contemporary novel, mm-hmm. which was so easy to write in comparison to this historical, because here in modern day, you can get in the car and go anywhere. You can take a plane. You can ride a bus. You can be in another country in a day. Back then, everything all the travel was on foot or by canoe, and that was it. So in writing that story, I realized how focused they were on the area they lived in and how much the natural world mattered to them because of that. This was the world they knew. And so setting a scene, you know, trying to transition scenes or make scenes appear in different places was tough because they didn't go anywhere. You know, this 11-year-old girl was heavily guarded. If she did go to Jamestown, in my book, she does. A lot of people went with her. It was a full-day journey on foot. You know, that was the kind of thing you had to deal with. So the setting itself was kind of limiting in some way, writing the historical. So mm-hmm. the challenge was to try and make different scenes happen in different areas within the village or within the forested area around them or within near Jamestown or on these rivers. But that's kind of the location issue you're dealing with in a historical. So it's different. You kind of very focused in on the landscape and the natural world, which is so important to the culture. So there's kind of a sadness in a sense too, to mm-hmm. see that, you know, the colonists came looking for natural resources. So, there was a lot of exploitation in that sense too. So it's kind of a sad time, time of change.
And when you're writing the book to immerse yourself in the mood of all that world, did you listen to music? Did you?
Oh. I burn incense when I write. It's always been my, as soon as I light that incense and I smell it, it's time to settle down and
write.
It
brings you back.
So, but I've always felt it's really important to have sensory detail in the writing, touches and smells and all of that. So you kind of have to imagine the setting because we're not on the East Coast here. And then write that into the story. And I think if you know your character well, you can kind of see it through her eyes and sense that world. And if you really immerse yourself in it and let her speak through you, you kind of, you have access to all of that.
Great point. Well, I know that in addition to writing and researching, you also market and promote other authors. What would you like to tell all those writers out there who envision a story and dream of making it come to life? Is it the sensory details, doing your research? Any advice for the writers out there?
I think the most important element of writing a story like this, or any story, is to really feel your characters, to immerse yourself in your characters, especially your main character. I think you have to know what she wants, what she longs for, what her dreams are, what her fears or hopes, her what she loves, what she hates. You have to have a deep, deep sense of who she is to write her story, especially if you're telling it in first person. You know, from a perspective of history, you have to have that. If you don't have that, I think you'd be lost. So I think that's the most important thing, is to really feel the character, immerse yourself in character. And then those sensory details, to me personally, I just find that to be the most excruciatingly hard and important part of writing, because I think you have to put the reader in the scene and have the reader see what she's seeing and what she's feeling and what she can touch and smell and hear. So yes, those sensory details are all part of it. And if it's happened in the past, or if it's in an area you don't know well, you have to research that area. If there are, you know, if there's nature involved or elements involved, you have to know the timing for those and what animals are in those areas.
Right.
And you have to understand all of that too. So
do your homework.
Yeah, getting the sensory detail down and doing the homework, but mostly immersing yourself in the character. So after a while, you hear her voice in your head and she speaks. I mean, you start to feel like you're channeling that person, and
Wonderful.
She's writing her story. And then it's true. I think then at that point, the character takes over and the writer just gets out of the way.
Wonderful. One last question, Paula.
Yes.
What book is next, and when can we expect to see it?
Well, as you know, this is part one of her story. So this book focuses mainly on John Smith's arrival in the colony and some of the coming of age experiences that she has as an 11-year-old girl who's maturing, who's betrothed to be married, who's the daughter of a chief. So all of those events in her life are kind of captured in part one. Part two, the story picks up after John Smith leaves. She marries Kokoam. She's abducted. And then that part of the story happens next. So I'm writing part two right now. And it's going to take a couple of years, I think, to get that written and polished up. And then I have an idea for another novel later on. That one will be set in Hawaii. It takes place in Molokai in the time of Father Damien. So that's kind of cooking in the back burner right now. But I'm focused on part two right now of this story.
And I know you have some events coming up.
I do. Yeah. It's November is National Native American Heritage Month. So I've been asked to speak at 5 of the local libraries here in San Diego.
Great.
The first appearance will be on November 8th at the Community University Branch Library at 12:30. And the following Saturday, the 15th, I'll be at the Pacific Beach Taylor Branch Library at 12:30. The following Tuesday, November 18th, I'll be at the Claremont Branch Library at 6:30 p.m., so that'll be an evening talk. And then the last day of appearances is November 22nd, and I'll be at 2 libraries that day. In the morning, at 12 o'clock noon, I'll be at the Rancho Penasquitos Branch Library, and then at 2 o'clock, I'll be appearing at the Oceanside Branch Library. And at that event, there will be powwow drummers from 1 to 2 p.m., and then I'll speak from 2 to 3, and then the library is offered to have some food trucks, some Native food brought in, so that will be a whole Native American event.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah, highlighting the month, so
great.
That'll be the final kickoff on the 22nd.
Well, Paula, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
For more information on Paula Margulies, her work, and her blog, please visit her website at paulamargulies.com, and that's spelled PAULAMARGULIES. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. KPBS and Union Bank are honoring two inspiring individuals in honor of American Indian Heritage Month through their Local Heroes program, which pays tribute to exemplary leaders who are making a difference and enriching the lives of others by improving their community, their region, and the world at large. This year's honorees for the American Indian Heritage Month are Dr. Daniel Kalick and Roy Cook. Dr. Kalick is the medical director of the Indian Health Council, which is a consortium of 9 tribes dedicated to the betterment of Indian health, wholeness, and well-being. A principal investigator of the California Native American Research Centers for Health, Dr. Kalick was born and raised on the Pama Indian Reservation locally. He began his pathway in medicine as a tribal doctor. He received his bachelor's degree in biology from San Diego State University and a medical degree from Harvard Medical School, where he was awarded the Arthur Ashe Foundation Fellow at the Harvard AIDS Institute. Dr. Kalick participated in the Four Directions Summer Program. That's a student-run project that brings Native American undergraduates to Harvard to perform research, shadow physicians, and meet Native American medical students. He's a member of the Luiseno Band of Mission Indians, the Intertribal Youth Advisory Board, and a board member of the California State University San Marcos Foundation. Roy Cook is a tribal writer, author, journalist, native singer, and artist born in Arizona of Utan, Opata, and Oklahoma, Wazazi, Osage heritage. An Army veteran, he is the president and the historian of the San Diego American Indian Warriors Association. He also serves as the tribal historian for the Southern California American Indian Resource Center in San Diego County. Mr. Cook is a member of the Golden State Gourd Dance Society and Western Oklahoma Comanche Gourd Clan. He has served as the curator of the American Indian Cultural Center Museum, San Diego Balboa Park, and the Indian Human Resources Center, Inc. He has published more than 300 stories for print and online covering many Native American topics, and he has taught at numerous colleges here in San Diego, including Palomar College, Mesa Community College, and Grossmont College in East County, where he also served as chairman of the Multicultural Studies Department. KPBS General Manager Tom Carlos says KPBS is honored to continue its partnership with Union Bank to celebrate these local heroes during American Indian Heritage Month. Through their efforts in our communities, he says, these extraordinary individuals improve the quality of life for all. For more information or to nominate a future local hero, you can visit kpbs.org/heroes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County includes the Aztecs homecoming game, a hike by the light of the moon, the musical Mulan, an acorn harvest festival, and a holiday open house at Summers Past Farms.
Plus, we'll have previews of coming attractions, including a free concert by the Pomerado Brass Quintet and the much-anticipated East County holiday tradition, the Mother Goose Parade.
So stay tuned for all these events and much, much more from East County Magazine.
Young Actors Theater in Spring Valley will present the Disney musical Mulan. The performance will be held Thursdays through Sundays from November 6th through November 16th. The musical tells the tale of Mulan, who defies the village matchmaker to take up arms, disguised as a boy in order to spare her father from having to serve in the army. But after the Huns invade, it's up to Mulan and her mischievous sidekick Mushu to save the emperor. For tickets, visit yatsandiego.org.
You're invited to hike by the light of the moon on Friday, November 7th at 6 p.m. on the Santa Isabel Preserve. Meet at 600 Farmer Road in Julian and bring a flashlight along with warm clothes, water, and sturdy hiking shoes. Dogs on a leash are welcome.
Hauka! In celebration of the acorn harvest once held by local Native Americans in these foothills, the Lewis H. Stelzer County Park in Lakeside will hold an acorn harvest festival on Sunday, November 8th from 1 to 4 p.m. Guests will learn Kumeyaay traditions as the park comes alive with interactive displays, crafts, storytelling, and acorn grinding. The park is located at 11470 Wildcat Canyon Road in Lakeside.
The San Diego State Aztecs will be playing the University of Idaho Vandals on Sunday, November 9th at 3:30 p.m. in Qualcomm Stadium. The KGB Sky Show will also light up the night with fireworks in celebration of San Diego State's homecoming. For tickets, visit Ticketmaster.com.
Summers Past Farms in Flynn Springs will hold an old-fashioned holiday open house on Thursday, November 13th from 5 until 8 p.m. Enjoy Christmas music, hot wassail, and homemade cookies along with live music by Jim Thorpe. The farm will be illuminated with holiday lights, and visitors can also browse for gifts and holiday home decor in the soap shop and barn filled with trimmings of the season.
And now for a preview of coming attractions.
The Pomerado Brass Quintet will perform a free concert on Sunday, November 16th in the Mission Trails Regional Visitor Center at 3 p.m. The quintet performs a variety of music, including classical, marches, jazz, ragtime, Dixieland, and selections from Broadway musicals. For more information, visit mtrp.org.
The Mother Goose Parade in El Cajon will roll out on Sunday, November 23rd, with a new route and a new start time at 12:15 p.m., the largest parade of its kind, featuring fairy tale floats, marching bands, equestrian entries, and Santa Claus, will start on Valentine Street, head down Main Street in Johnson, before ending at the Mother Goose Village in Parkway Plaza Shopping Center. The Mother Goose Village will be a two-day event open Saturday and Sunday, November 22nd and 23rd. There will be a red carpet on Main Street and WD Hall Drive at 10:30 a.m. before the parade kicks off. Visit mothergooseparade.org for more information.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Today, we thought it would be a good time to replay our interview with Sequan Chairman Daniel Tucker, taped originally at the debut of their Emmy Award-winning film about the history of the Sequan people and the Kumeyaay Nation.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. I'm here today at Sequan with Daniel Tucker, the chairman of the Sequan Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. Today they are debuting a brand new documentary film called Our People, Our Culture, Our History, and it's about the history of the Sequan Band and the Kumeyaay Nation. Chairman Tucker, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. We're really excited about that.
Tell us about the film. What made you decide to make this documentary?
You know, if you would go downtown today or anywhere in the United States, let's say in San Diego, mm-hmm. and you ask the average person out there, do you know what Sequan is? And can you explain to me what an Indian tribe is? And they'll say, yeah. They talk about the Plains Indians. They don't talk about the Indians from California. Because they talk about teepees and those kind of things. That's what they always say in schools and all that kind of stuff. But we lived in huts here in San Diego County because of the climate. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to dress like they did back in the Plains Indians. What happened with us is that since the climate was so well, we used to make our huts out of willow branches. And that's why we live. That's how we made our villages. And we want people to know who we really are. We're not Plains Indians. We're Indians from California. And we call ourselves Natives now, but Native Americans, which is even...
Right, the original Native Californians.
Exactly. So what's so exciting about this whole documentary, it tells the history of the Kumeyaay people now, here in San Diego County.
And does it include the Kumeyaay in what's now Mexico?
Yes,
as well?
It does. What was unfortunate, when they put up the border, a lot of our tribes who were Kumeyaay tribes still are still there. And sometimes it's pretty difficult to go see them because we have to go across the border, have to do this. We take them stuff like clothes or anything we can. We have to go through a lot of bureaucracy to do that. Mm-hmm. But they're still doing fine down there. But they are our brothers and sisters, which is pretty interesting. When we decided to do this documentary, we didn't want it to be a story, per se. We want to tell the real history, what happened to the Native Americans in San Diego County and in California. What was the life like? How did we live? What did we eat? Where we lived? In the summertime, we lived in the mountains. And in wintertime, we lived down by the ocean, because that's where food is plenty. We lived a lot along the Sweetwater River right there, because that's where all the water was, fresh water, and the San Diego River as well. Mm-hmm. One of our biggest villages was right below Presidio Park, where the Great War Old Town is.
Yes.
And that was to be a huge Native village at the time. Then, unfortunately, when the big migration came from the east, we ended up with 1 square mile of land out of all the land here in California. And even in San Diego County, we got 1 square
wow.
mile.
Such a tragedy.
640 acres. And if you ever come out here and see Sequan, the original reservation, you see half of it's a mountain. Mm-hmm. So we've had very little land to work with. But we survived. We survived what we did, and we started to, you know, go with the way of life as it was at the time. When they opened up the first school in Dehesa Valley, that school is over 130 years old, and our people went there. And it was really strange to them because they weren't allowed to speak our language. They had to speak the white man's language, and they had to deal with that.
Adopt the dress and the customs of the white man.
Adopt the dress and customs, the whole bit. And it was a scary time for us. It was really a time where wow, what's going to happen with us?
It was really a sense of cultural genocide, in a sense, wasn't it?
Totally in California. Not just in San Diego County, but all the way up along the coast. The first governor of California, I forgot his name, his biggest comment was, a good Indian is a dead Indian.
Wow.
And that was unfortunate. But I don't know if you ever heard a story about Ishii.
Yes.
He's
the last Indian of his particular tribe.
That's right, up in the Sacramento area. And Mrs. Hurst took him in. And somebody knew his language, and they finally got to talk to him a little bit. But, it was a genocidal thing. But we persevered. We just, we hung in there. We had to do what we had to do to survive. And we did. And what's happening today, doing this documentary, we want the people of San Diego and this country to know who we really are as a people. We've been here for 12,000 years. And how we lived, where we went to pick our acorns, our harvest time. We do All Souls Day. Mm-hmm. And our traditions and culture have, and since we started doing this, the gaming hole situation, and I have to explain this, is very, very important. People think of Indian tribes today as casino-owned. Casinos are a part of our business. We are a government first. No ifs and buts about it. We are a government. And we have to treat our people as we would like to be treated. And we want to be fair. We want to be sure that our government is running like it should be. So at the time, they didn't call us chiefs. They called us captains during those days. And the captain had all the responsibility to making sure their tribe ate. There was enough food for everyone. If somebody shot a deer, all the families got to eat.
So the casino is, in a sense, a modern-day means of bringing prosperity to the Native American people, and it's certainly not the only business venture that Sequan has. Tell us a little bit about, for people who don't know, some of the other things you're doing today and some of the things you've done for the community, the broader community as well.
Yeah, it's exciting to me, being part of this. I was chairman when we did Prop 5 and Prop 1A. And that was to have legalized gaming in California. Mm-hmm. The Indians of California changed the Constitution of California, enabling us to do what we have today. And so we have our casino, but what's bigger than that, we're allowed to diversify, and that we're doing. We bought the U.S. Grant Hotel, 4th and Broadway downtown. We own the land under the Solomar Hotel, downtown San Diego. We have a business called Marina Gateway down in National City, and we also have a... this is really cool. The golf course. The old Singing Hills Golf Course is now Sequan Resort.
That's right.
So we just put those acres, 1,400, matter of fact, into trust status to make it a part of our reservation as of today. And we built new homes for our people. And right now we're doing the whole infrastructure, new water lines. All our telephone wires are going to go underground, the gas, the whole bit. And we're doing that on our own.
Good.
We're not asking anything from the state. All we ask them to do is let us do what we need to do to make ourselves survive. Because there's laws out there we have to find, environmental, all that stuff,
sure.
We still have to follow.
Speaking of environmental, last year you put on a conference down at the Grant Hotel about the impacts of some of the big energy and mining projects on indigenous people, including the Kumeyaay in Mexico.
That's correct.
Touched on at all in the documentary?
Not that part, just a little bit. We do have people on the other side of the border, but not that much. It's mostly about the Sequan and the Kumeyaay people of San Diego County.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't realize San Diego County has more tribes than any state in the continental United States.
Yes.
There are 18 tribes in San Diego County, and most of them are Kumeyaay. And if you need to understand, as our name says, we are the Sequan Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The word band is very important, because band is, we're a band, Hamul's a band, Viejas is a band, Campo, Manzanita, all those tribes out there who are bands of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Right.
So we have our own government on each individual reservation.
Now, in recent times, Sequan has been very good neighbors to the broader community. The Sequan Band has given back quite a bit. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about
that? Yes, I think that is extremely important to this tribe, because what we have here is a situation where we live in San Diego. We're part of San Diego. We're part of our community. And we've always been taught by our elders, always give something to somebody. And in this case, we're giving back to San Diego County. Like this past weekend, I didn't run. I walked for the Susan Komen Breast Cancer Walk.
Okay, good.
And we give $30,000 for that, to be part of the sponsorship for that, because it's very important to us. We gave to Radish Children's Hospital. the Diabetes Association, all the things that people really are involved in off
yes,
the reservation.
Fire protection.
Fire protection a whole bit. In fact, our fire department covers all of the Dehesa Valley. And it's just, most of the people here appreciate it. There are some who still
sure.
have some issues, yeah. but mm-hmm. still, we're doing the right thing. We are giving back to our community, and we think that's important. Because San Diego comes to play here. Mm-hmm. They come and enjoy what we have here at Sequan, whether it be the casino, the hotel, the resort, mm-hmm. or anything that we have. People seem to go there more often because, one, they know we give them back to San
yes.
Diego. When I was bowling, all the people used to come to me, we play at Sequan because we know you give back to the community. And that just makes you feel good. People do notice those things.
Yes, that's very important.
And what this documentary is telling you is that we are that kind of people, the people who are going to give back, the people who give.
Excellent.
I'll tell you, this is important. We invite people out to the reservation. Are they come and visit us? The first thing we ask them, are you hungry?
Mm-hmm.
And we take them in to feed them. During some of the people coming across the border, sometimes illegally, that's okay, but those people are hungry too.
Sure.
So we fed them. We fed them and nourished them and gave them water and those kind of things because we don't want nobody to starve or nobody to be hurt. So we opened them with opened arms. San Diego has been a great part of that, us being able to do those things.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's gone into the making of this documentary? How big a project was this?
A lot. It was huge. It's been working this over a year. And one of our tribal members named Cody Martinez, he's actually he took the lead in this thing. Because I can't do everything, Mr. Chairman, because I have so much sort of stuff to deal with. And he took this and embraced it and did a tremendous job with it. Did a tremendous job. He got to all our elders. He's gotten to Ms. Florence Shipek when she was alive. She was an anthropologist in this area and really did a whole study of the Kumeyaay people. The Museum of Man, we use them, and we use all the high-ranking anthropologists and historians in San Diego who really had a part in making of this film.
I know that it's a Kumeyaay tradition to think seven generations ahead. If you look seven generations ahead, Chairman,
we look
what do you want?
Seven generations.
What do you want to see for the future for the Sequan Band and the Kumeyaay Nation?
I see this tribe still being what it is, never forgetting who we are, where we are, and where we came from. But they have to protect our sovereign right as a government and a nation in the United States, because that's important. Because without that sovereignty issue, we're just like everybody else. But because we do have that sovereign status, we are a government, and we use it as that, and we be fair, we work with our people, as the people are our bosses. So when you're elected, you better do the right thing for our people, not just for one individual. It has to be for everybody.
We would all be better off if every elected official had that attitude.
Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great?
Yes. Thank you very, very much. Is there any final words that you have for us?
I'd like to say just come out to Sequan, and maybe you see the casino, that's fine, but look at the land itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got to tell my daughter, her name is Charlene, she says, the land don't belong to us. We belong to the land. That quote just stuck with me until this day, and it's just the truth. We are protectors of the land, and we do that.
Very good. And listeners can visit the Sequan website. It's sequan.com, and view the documentary online also. I understand our people, our culture, our history, the history of the Sequan Band and the Kumeyaay Nation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chairman.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Brian Boykel, Kevin McLeod, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.